Imagine you walk into your office tomorrow morning, right? And you find out that every single department wall has been completely knocked down.
Oh, man. That is a nightmare scenario for most people.
Right. And I am not talking about like a trendy open plan office redesign with ping pong tables. I mean, the actual organizational boundaries, marketing, sales, HR, operations, all dissolved.
Just wiped out.
Exactly. And leadership announces that starting today, there is only one single unifying priority for everyone in the building. Everything else is secondary to that one goal.
You know, that scenario sends a very specific cold shiver down the spine of anyone who has survived a major corporate restructuring.
Oh, absolutely.
We find comfort in our boundaries. We rely on knowing exactly what our specific silo is responsible for, and perhaps more importantly, what we can safely ignore, because it falls under the umbrella of not my department.
Yeah, the old not my job defense.
Exactly. Removing that safety net creates profound, almost existential organizational anxiety.
Well, welcome to your deep dive today. If you are navigating a shift like that, or if you simply want to understand the mechanics of massive institutional change, you are in the right place.
We've got a really great one today.
We really do. We are unpacking a fascinating piece of source material. It's titled The Single Silo University by Gordon Fletcher, Richard Drawn, and Monica Damal-Gimeno.
And it chronicles a radical 5-year strategic plan running from 2016 to 2021, executed by the University of Salford over in the UK.
Right. And I want to set the hook early here. While our grounding source operates in the realm of higher education, the insights here transcend academia.
Completely.
This paper offers a raw, unvarnished look at what it actually takes to break down entrenched internal silos, navigate the inevitable and fierce workplace pushback, and completely redefine the metrics of how a massive institution creates value in the real world.
Because human nature, when faced with sudden structural change, remains remarkably consistent. Whether you are at a massive tech conglomerate or a public university, people react the exact same way.
So true. So to grasp just how disruptive this shift was at Salford, we have to look at the baseline. Like, how did they handle external partnerships before 2016?
Right, the before picture.
Yeah. The paper uses the term kitchen table activities to describe their old model.
Which, honestly, kitchen table is a rather generous way of describing a highly fractured individualistic system.
How so?
Well, prior to this new strategy, if an academic managed to secure a relationship with an external business, the university largely treated it as an afterthought. It was basically a basic reporting exercise.
So they weren't really supporting it.
Not at all. These partnerships were ad hoc. They were driven by individual professors sitting at their own proverbial kitchen tables, acting in almost total isolation from the rest of the university's teaching or broader research initiatives.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to understand the resistance, you have to understand the psychology of the people involved.
Definitely.
Academics, especially those with tenure, often view themselves more like independent scholars who, you know, merely happen to be parked at a specific university.
That's very true.
It's akin to a collection of fiercely independent franchise owners who have spent decades running their own idiosyncratic, highly customized local shops.
Yes, perfect analogy.
And suddenly, a new CEO steps in and demands they all execute one rigid, unified corporate menu. That feels like a direct threat to their professional identity, not just a shift in their daily tasks.
That perspective is crucial. The academic identity is rooted deeply in autonomy. So when the 2016 strategy introduced these industrial collaboration zones and made business partnering the absolute sole strategic institutional priority, that autonomy was directly challenged.
They were forcing everyone into this single silo.
Exactly. And the pushback was layered. Some staff claimed they were already doing this, you know, dismissing the mandate as bureaucratic noise.
A classic, we already do that defense.
Right. And others actively argued that prioritizing business partnerships was a dangerous distraction from their true mandate, which they saw as traditional classroom teaching and isolated academic research.
And the university's management structure practically guaranteed a spectacular clash, didn't it?
Oh, it was a recipe for disaster.
Because, like so many massive organizations, they were running a matrix management system. You have traditional heads of departments trying to manage budgets, handle sick leave, and basically just keep the basic machinery running.
The day-to-day survival stuff.
Yeah. But to enforce this new single-silo vision, the university brought in new portfolio leaders.
And those portfolio leaders were explicitly hired to be disruptors. Their mandate was to look at the big picture and force the integration of external partnerships across all disciplines.
Man, so instantly the friction is structural.
Totally.
A department manager's priority is reactive, putting out today's fire so the staff doesn't burn out. But the portfolio leader's priority is proactive, demanding that those same stressed out staff members completely reinvent how they interact with external businesses.
You have two different leadership roles being evaluated on completely contradictory metrics.
It's just wild. Let me get this straight, though. The old metric for success was so broken that an academic could basically bill their time for having a single cup of coffee with a CEO.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because the paper notes that before this shift, the definition of a good partnership was incredibly flimsy.
Yeah.
If an email thread used to count towards someone's workload allocation, I completely understand why they would riot over a new system that actually scrutinized the depth of their work.
The variability across departments was indeed staggering. Some academics presented robust, multi-layered collaborations that genuinely integrated student learning and applied research.
Right, the real deal.
But others submitted what amounted to a semi-regular coffee catch-up, or, like you said, an occasional email exchange as their strategic partnership.
Wow.
This is the inherent danger of poorly defined organizational metrics. If management designates an email thread as a valid partnership, the staff will inevitably optimize for email threads.
Path of least resistance.
Exactly. Mm. So this ambiguity forced the authors of the paper to look outward. They dove into established relationship management theories to build a rigorous, undeniable baseline for what constitutes a quality relationship.
Right. They didn't just guess. They pulled from three major schools of thought. The source mentions the Nordic School, the Industrial Marketing and Purchasing Group, or IMP, and the Anglo-Australian School.
Yes. Heavy hitters in the marketing world.
But, I mean, to anyone outside of a marketing PhD program, those names don't mean much on their own.
Let's translate those theories into the actual mechanisms Salford used. So, the Nordic School emphasizes interactive marketing and service logic, essentially arguing that you aren't just delivering a product, you are providing a continuous service.
Okay, so no more one-and-done transactions.
Right. Then the IMP group views business relationships not as isolated transactions, but as continuous networking within a web of different actors.
A network, okay.
And finally, the Anglo-Australian School focuses heavily on relationship economics and the quality of the service to ensure customer retention.
So blending those three theories together exposes a massive structural flaw in how the university was operating. It highlights a fundamental size mismatch.
Yes, this is a key insight.
A university is a sprawling, massive entity, but they were approaching partnerships with local, often much smaller businesses, using a B2C business-to-consumer mindset.
They were treating local businesses the exact same way they treat incoming undergraduate students, like consumers of a one-off product.
Interesting.
In a B2C transaction, the business comes with a specific problem. The university provides a short-term consultation or a single piece of research. The transaction is completed, and the relationship essentially goes dormant.
But those relationship management theories argue that to generate actual value, the university had to evolve into a B2B business-to-business entity.
Precisely. They needed to abandon the retail mindset and cultivate continuous long-term relationships. Even if the intensity of the collaboration waxes and wanes depending on the season, the underlying network connection should never be severed. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the authors lean into the triple helix model.
Oh, right, the triple helix.
Yeah, this framework posits that in a modern knowledge economy, true innovation doesn't happen in a vacuum. It requires industry, academia, and government to act as intertwined strands of a single helix.
And the fuel for that engine is what, balanced reciprocation?
Exactly, balanced reciprocation.
I am curious how you achieve balanced reciprocation between a multi-billion dollar university and a mid-sized local manufacturing plant. I mean, the scales of value seem entirely disproportionate. What does the business actually want that makes it worth their time to jump through the university's bureaucratic hoops?
That is the million-dollar question. And the currency of balanced reciprocation in this context almost always boils down to one highly specific asset.
Which is?
Access to students.
Ah, of course.
Businesses want a pipeline to potential future graduates, and they want the immediate injection of fresh, unburdened perspectives that students bring to stagnant industry problems.
But under the old kitchen table model, academics often simplify their partnerships by intentionally keeping students out of the equation, right?
Oh, constantly. It was faster and easier for a professor to just consult on their own. But by cutting out the students, the academics were systematically stripping away the primary long-term value the business was seeking.
Wow. So redefining a partnership as a long-term reciprocal B2B network that mandates student integration, that requires a completely new internal scorecard. You cannot measure a deeply technical engineering collaboration using the exact same yardstick you use for a partnership with a local community theater.
Right, it's apples and oranges. So to solve that measurement problem, the strategy team synthesized their theoretical research into 13 specific variables for successful partnering.
13 variables.
Yes. This framework included metrics like goal setting, coordination, sustainability, creating multiple connections across different departments, and perhaps most crucially, offering real-world experience.
And they visualized these 13 variables using radar charts for self-assessment, which is super interesting. The source provides a vivid example by looking at a sport technology beacon partnership.
Yeah, that's a great case study in the paper.
Let's look at the mechanism behind just one parameter, real-world experience. They did not settle for a simple checkbox asking, you know, if students were involved. They implemented a rigorous 1-6 scoring scale.
Yes, and they were very strict about it. A score of 1 indicated a total failure on that metric. I mean, absolutely no student involvement, and students were entirely unaware the partnership even existed.
Yikes.
A score of 3 represented mediocrity. Perhaps a handful of students in a niche seminar were tangentially aware of the business. But to achieve a 6, the partnership had to demonstrate university-wide awareness, establish clear and accessible routes for any student to participate, and this is the kicker, prove a highly probable track record of the partner company actually hiring the students.
Wait, you are telling me management handed a bunch of already skeptical, overworked academics a new 13-point diagnostic checklist with radar charts, and instead of rioting, the staff actually embraced it?
Surprisingly, yes.
That sounds completely counterintuitive for a group that just claimed they were too busy for this initiative. How did they get them to care about a chart?
What's fascinating here is the underlying psychology of the academic ego.
Ah, the ego.
You were dealing with highly educated, inherently driven, and often deeply competitive individuals.
Right.
When you tie their performance to a highly visible, measurable radar chart, they will actively work to avoid being at the bottom of that scale.
Because nobody wants to look like they're failing.
Exactly. The portfolio leaders reported that staff began treating the 13 variables not as a punitive judgment, but as a shopping list.
A shopping list for their own ambition.
Precisely that. Mm. An academic would look at their chart, realize they were scoring a respectable 5 on communication, but a dismal 2 on multiple connections, and that visible deficit would just gnaw at them.
They couldn't stand it.
Right. So they started proactively dreaming up new cross-departmental activities to pitch to their business partners, purely to level up their chart. The rubric successfully gamified the incredibly difficult process of becoming more collaborative.
That structural gamification is brilliant. But, you know, so what does this all mean? Like, what about the variable of trust? When reviewing the 13 parameters, the natural assumption is that trust refers to convincing a skeptical external CEO to trust a slow-moving university.
That's what you would think.
But the data revealed something far more toxic, didn't it?
Oh, it was bad.
Yeah.
The lack of trust was not external. It was deeply and defensively internal.
Inside the university itself.
Yes. The legacy of those isolated kitchen table partnerships had bred a culture of intense paranoia. Different departments within the exact same university were actively and secretly competing against each other to secure the same external business partner.
Wait, really? I want to visualize the sheer dysfunction of that. So you have the head of the business school pitching a local hospital CEO on a leadership training partnership on Tuesday.
Right.
Then on Thursday, the head of the engineering school takes the same hospital CEO out for coffee to pitch a robotics collaboration without ever mentioning the business school.
And from the perspective of that hospital CEO, the university appears completely chaotic and opaque.
I mean, yeah, the left hand has no idea what the right hand is doing.
Exactly. The partner's expectations are muddied, the communications are fractured, and the bureaucratic burden on the business doubles. The source explicitly notes cases where this internal cannibalization caused deeply frustrated businesses to simply walk away from the university entirely.
That is embarrassing.
It was. But the academics were so terrified of another department cannibalizing their contact that they actively built moats around their partnerships, resisting any institutional transparency.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because diagnosing that specific internal sabotage is the turning point of the entire 5-year plan. To fix this massive issue of internal permeability, Management couldn't just tweak a spreadsheet. They had to execute a hostile takeover of the existing culture.
They realized that external collaboration is literally impossible if you are engaged in internal warfare.
Right.
Consequently, they developed 10 selfer behaviors.
10 behaviors.
Yes, these were single word behavioral attributes, things like connecting, co-creating, enabling, inspiring, daring, and so on. But they did not make the mistake of just printing these words on a motivational poster and hoping for the best.
No, they fundamentally changed how a person survives and advances within the institution. They embedded those 10 behaviors directly into the hiring matrix and the annual staff performance reviews.
They gave it teeth.
But how do you actually measure something as subjective as being daring during a job interview?
You measure it by demanding evidence of systemic disruption. In an interview, a candidate wouldn't just be asked about their publication record.
Oh.
They'd be asked to demonstrate a specific instance where they dared to pitch a highly unconventional cross-departmental project. They had to prove they were willing to risk their own department's immediate comfort for a broader collaborative win.
Wow. So the old rules were just gone.
Completely.
Right.
If you wanted to be hired or if you wanted a promotion, a pristine research record was no longer enough. You had to provide empirical evidence that you were a transparent collaborator, not a silo builder.
Forcing that behavioral shift unlocked what I consider the central revelation of this deep dive. As the walls between departments started to thin out, the strategy team realized that a massive institution doesn't actually do dozens of different things.
This was their light bulb moment.
Teaching undergraduates, conducting primary research, maintaining international networks, and fostering local business partnerships, they finally understood these are not distinct competing activities. They are merely different expressions of one singular mechanism, which is knowledge exchange.
This raises an important question about the fundamental mechanics of any organization. By distilling every activity down to knowledge exchange, the university officially transitioned to a service-centered business logic.
Break that down for me.
Well, value was no longer defined by the production of a tangible, static good, such as publishing a single journal article or handing a diploma to a single graduate. True value was redefined as the continuous, reciprocal flow of skills, data, and human capital between the institution and the outside world.
That philosophical shift had massive, tangible consequences for the students sitting in the classrooms.
It changed everything for them.
The source highlights that as the faculty internalized this single silo metric of knowledge exchange, the traditional stagnant model of education began to break down. Professors stopped relying on the tired trope of inviting a local CEO in for a one-hour, one-way guest lecture.
Thank goodness.
Right. Instead, they began integrating live, high-stakes, external business briefs directly into the daily curriculum.
The classroom became an extension of the business partnership. Students were no longer studying hypothetical case studies from a decade ago.
They were doing the real work.
Exactly. They were being assessed on their ability to solve real, immediate, and messy operational problems for the university's corporate partners. This marks the critical transition from hoarding to sharing.
Yeah, going back to what we said earlier.
Right. We discussed how academics historically viewed their partnerships as a competitive advantage, a closely guarded secret weapon utilized to elevate their individual prestige.
The moat building.
Yes. The new structural incentives forced a migration toward collaborative advantage. The professional reward only materialized when the academics shared the relationship across internal departments and actively integrated the student body into the work.
The ultimate validation of this grueling five-year crucible is the caliber of the partnerships they secured by the end of the strategic period. They didn't just accumulate a higher volume of small contracts.
No, they went big.
They forged a maturing, massively complex, multi-organizational partnership that anchored the region's economy. We are talking about integrating the NHS Foundation Trust, the Salford City Council, Peel Holdings, which is a massive real estate and infrastructure conglomerate, and the university itself, all operating in tandem.
The source makes an unequivocal point about this, that level of high stakes, regional economic integration is entirely impossible without the pain of the preceding five-year internal restructuring.
You have to do the internal work first.
The university had to learn how to operate as a single, reliable, transparent entity internally before it could ever hope to serve as the linchpin for regional development externally. They transformed into a destination for corporate innovation, primarily because they stopped fighting themselves.
It is a phenomenal blueprint for change, but, you know, The authors are academics, so they provide a necessary, sobering reality check regarding timelines.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone who has survived a corporate overhaul knows that cultural transformation does not neatly align with a 5-year fiscal plan.
The authors are highly transparent about that caveat. Rewiring entrenched human behavior takes significantly longer than one strategic cycle. One of the most glaring frustrations highlighted in the paper is the lag associated with national excellence metrics.
The scorecards.
Right. In the UK higher education system, institutions are judged by massive systemic scorecards, like the Knowledge Exchange Framework, the Teaching Excellence Framework, and the Research Excellence Framework.
And those frameworks are inherently backward-looking, aren't they?
Exactly the problem. The Research Excellence Framework, for example, relies heavily on peer-reviewed publications. The life cycle of conducting research, submitting it, navigating peer review, and finally publishing takes years.
It's a crawl.
It really is. Similarly, knowledge exchange metrics often rely on historical income data from past contracts. Therefore, a massive, real-time cultural shift toward vibrant daily collaboration in 2017 will not actually register on the official national scorecards until the next evaluation cycle years later.
Oh, that has to be so frustrating for leadership.
Incredibly. The university was objectively functioning at a much higher level, but the official metrics severely lagged behind the operational reality on the ground.
Which brings this entirely back to you listening to this breakdown. Whether you are actively navigating a corporate reorganization, trying to scale a rapidly growing startup without accidentally building walls, or fighting for resources in academia, the core lesson of the Salford experiment is universal.
It applies everywhere.
Transitioning from isolated, individualistic kitchen table tasks to a unified, transparent network of knowledge exchange is going to be incredibly painful. It will trigger deep structural friction. Your top performers might fight it the hardest because it threatens their autonomy.
But the collective power and external trust it unlocks is undeniable. It forces an entire organization to stop asking the localized question, "What do I do?" and forces them to answer the systemic question, what value do we co-create together?
I'll leave you with a final thought to mull over today. Consider those organizational walls we talked about knocking down at the very beginning of this deep dive.
The nightmare scenario.
Yeah. If your own workplace suddenly stripped away every separate department, every distinct job title, and every competing internal metric, what would your one single metric for true organizational value actually look like? And perhaps more importantly, who in your office would be the most terrified by that level of absolute transparency?
A deeply provocative question to end on.
Thanks for joining your deep dive today. We'll catch you in the next one.